are listening to a message from Stonegate Church. For more information about Stonegate and additional audio resources, please visit stonegate.church.
So if we rewind the clock about a year ago, this would have been Christmas Day 2024. Matthew and his wife Lila and their two daughters, they had just celebrated Christmas Eve, kind of within their family context the night before. They'd had a great night together. They go to sleep on Christmas Eve, eager for the next day, and then their family does not see them at their extended Christmas gathering, kind of the extended family get-together. So they're obviously very concerned about where they are. So they call the police, and the police do a welfare check on the house. And the police walk into their home, and they find Matthew, Lila, and their daughters had all mysteriously died. And they quickly realized why. The home heating system had malfunctioned, and the family were the victims of a silent, odorless, invisible poison called carbon monoxide. Now, just as a encouragement to everyone in this room, you should probably just get a $20 monitor in your house. That would be a good thing for you to do. But in our passage today, it sort of functions like an alarm. It's meant to be that alarm in your house so that you can recognize there is an odorless, invisible, silent poison that's in you, that's around you, that would love to make a home in you. This passage is meant to do that, just to signal in your life that there is a poison that is far more deadly than carbon monoxide, that has killed far more people forever than carbon monoxide. Paul is sounding the alarm. Philippians chapter 2. He is alerting us. He's sounding the alarm to this poisonous thing the Bible calls pride. Pride. Pride in the scriptures is the killer of all killers. Pride in the Bible is the poison that is above all poisons. It is like the most dangerous thing out there, this word pride, which is why Charles Spurgeon warns us. He says, there's no sin into which the heart of man so easily falls as pride. And yet there is no vice which is more frequently and more emphatically and more eloquently condemned in scriptures. Pride is the worst monstrosity of all the monstrous things in creation. If you want to have a madman in your heart, he says, well, embrace pride, for you'll never find one as mad as he. Oh, my friends, you cannot tell how many shapes pride will assume. So look sharply at yourself, or you will be deceived by it. And when you think you're entertaining angels, you will find that you have been receiving devils unaware. This is pride. Pride is that vice in the Bible that is, there's just nothing more frequently condemned as that. God has a lot to say about pride. He condemns it at every turn in the Bible. It really is in the Bible the worst monstrosity of all the monstrous things. It really is, according to the scriptures, that madman that if you turn him loose will wreck everything in your life. Pride is a shape shifter. It takes all kinds of forms in our life. So Paul is inviting us, right? It's the alarm. It's sounding in our life, and he's inviting us to take a sharp look at ourselves so that this deadly poison does not find a home in us. What is pride? This deadly poison, what is it? Well, John Stott talks about it like this. He says, it's the stubborn refusal to let God be God, with the corresponding ambition to take his place. He goes on, it's the attempt to dethrone God and enthrone ourselves. That's a really good way to think about pride. Think about pride as self-deification. God, you ain't gonna be God. I'm gonna be God. There's only one person that can be on that throne. It's not going to be you. It's going to be me. It's self-deification. Charles Bridges, he was a pastor in England in the 1800s. He talks about it like this. Pride lifts up one's heart against God and contends for supremacy with him. This is what pride does. If you want to think about when pride is operating in our life, that poison is in us. Here is what it makes us do. It makes us look at God and say, I'm going to contend with you for who's going to be on that throne. Who is going to be supreme in this world? This is pride. This is why C.S. Lewis called pride the complete anti-God state of mind. He goes on to say, pride is saying in every act and in every word, my will be done. God, not your will, my will be done. This is the heart of pride. Pride's this insane attempt to put ourselves in the place of God. It's us reaching for the reins. It's that stubborn refusal to let God be God and for us to be God's creation, for us to be dependent upon God. It just refuses to do that. It refuses to play that role and let God play his role. So in the scriptures, pride really is at the root of every other sin. If you just want to sort of crack sin open and then peer all the way down to the bottom of it, what you will find all the way down at the bottom of sin is the root of pride. So John Stott says, pride then is more than the first of the seven deadly sins. Pride is itself the essence of all sin. Or Augustine, in a really bright metaphor, he says it this way. Pride is like a mother who is pregnant with every other sin. This is pride in our life. And we should look sharply at ourselves to see if that poison is in us. And it does take a sharp look because pride really is a shape shifter. It'll take a million different forms in our life. Let me just give you the categories you could maybe think of. Form one that it loves to take is a person who would say, I'm so wonderful, so world, praise me. You world out there, look at me and how awesome I am. I'm so wonderful, so praise me. But it also has another form, a more subtle form. Pride also can sound like this. I am so wounded, hurt, wrong, the victim of every one of you people out there, so world, pity me. But both of those are forms of pride. I'm so wonderful, praise me, is what happens when a self-focused, self-centered, self-loving heart gets what it wants. Everything is going great in their life. And the heart that says, I'm so wounded, pity me, is what happens when a self-focused, self-centered, self-loving heart gets hurt. It doesn't get what it wants in life. But the problem in both is that they're self-centered. It's all about them. It's self-love, self-focus. And the Bible just reminds us over and over again that God opposes the proud. Like God is actively working against the proud. There is a steady resolve in the heart of God to oppose the poison of pride. God is not okay when we contend with supremacy with him. Let me just give you a couple of illustrations of this. If you want a great, sort of case study on pride, think King Nebuchadnezzar. This is in Daniel chapter 4. King Nebuchadnezzar has this massive empire. And so we read here that one night he is on his balcony looking at how great everything is. And here we go in Daniel 4. We pick it up and it says this. He says, is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power? I have built it. It is the evidence of my power, he says, as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty. Right? This is just pride on display. I'm so wonderful, so world, look at me and all that I have done. But God opposes the proud. While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field. And you shall be made to eat grass like an ox until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom it wills. God opposes the proud. Another illustration is Herod in Acts chapter 12. We read this in Acts 12. On an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robe. So this is the ruler of the area. He's at the top of the heap. This is Herod. So he puts on his royal robes. He took his seat upon the throne and delivered an oration to them. And the people were shouting, "This is the voice of a god, not of a man." But God opposes the proud. He opposes those who contend with supremacy with him. So immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. Could we all agree on this? The last thing you want in your life is for God to oppose you, for God to actively be working against you. The last thing you want in your life is for that to be true. But the Bible is clear. God opposes the proud. And when that poison of pride is filling up your heart in order to love you, God actively has to work against you, to oppose you. God opposes the proud. So Paul sounds the alarm in Philippians 2. Look at verses 3 and 4. He says, "So do nothing from selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others." And I just want to point out these three little key words. But in humility. This is the alarm Paul is sounding. No to pride, yes to humility, but in humility. What does that word humility mean? What is humility? Well, we could say that humility is the opposite of pride. That's one way to talk about it. Where pride is a poison like carbon monoxide that suffocates us. On the other hand, humility is like oxygen to our lungs that allows us to thrive in how we relate to God and other people. This is humility in our life. Andrew Murray, he describes it like this. He says, humility is the place of entire dependence upon God. That's humility. Entire dependence upon God. He says, it's the first duty and the highest virtue of the creature and the root of every other virtue. So what is humility? It's the place of entire dependence upon God. And just like if you were to crack sin open and stare all the way down at the bottom, you would find the root of pride down there. If you were to crack open obedience, virtue on this side, and look all the way down at the bottom, what you would find down there is humility. It's underneath every act of obedience to God. Humility sees the world rightly. Humility is glad to say, God, you are God and I'm not. God, you have everything, and I need everything. Humility is happy to say that, so now we get to recognize who God is, who we are, how God has made the world to work. Humility gives us that gift of recognizing God and the way he has wired everything to work in this world. And Paul gives us the shape of humility in this text. Verse 3, he says, "Do nothing from selfish ambition." Paul is not against ambition. Ambition in the Bible is a good thing, not a bad thing. Ambition is what we call a human heart saying, God is doing things in this world and I want to participate with God in what he's doing. God has good works for me to do and I want to do those good works that he has called me to do. God is bringing more and more of his kingdom down to this earth, to this world, and I just want to participate in the work of God in doing that. So ambition is not bad. Paul is not against ambition. The question is, what is animating our ambition? Is it pride or is it humility? Here is what Paul calls bad. Selfish ambition, prideful ambition. Pride takes ambition and turns it ugly. Pride poisons ambition. Pride takes ambition that should be for God and for other people and centers it on ourselves. Makes it all about us. We're not loving other people in this ambition. We are using other people for our own selfish ends. That's what the poison of pride does to ambition. And so Paul is saying, do nothing from selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, count others more significant than yourselves. Pride, here's what it does in your heart and in my heart. It turns us inward, turns us in. This is what pride does. It's the reason that, think about the last time you saw a picture with you in it. Who did you look at first? There's a reason. The reason's called pride. The reason is because when you see the world, you natively, because of sin, see yourself first in the world. Care about yourself first in the world. This is what pride feels like. When I'm looking at the world, the person I think about, see first, consider first, is me, not God, not other people. Right? This is pride showing up in a human heart. Pride makes us see ourselves as the main character in the story. And now other people may be on the stage of our story, but they're all supporting actors. So God is a supporting actor in my story. My friends are supporting actors in my story. Everyone else around me is a supporting actor in my story. But the story is about me and my awesomeness. This is pride. Pride makes it impossible to see others unless we can use others to get what we want. Then we'll see them. But this is what pride does to us. So pride turns us in. Humility turns us out. Now we can see God and we can see other people. Humility gives us this amazing gift in that way. This is why Paul says, in humility, count others as more significant than yourselves. In saying that, Paul is not saying you don't matter. He's saying there's just something else that matters more. And humility sees something else matters more. God, other people, that matter more. And I love that word count. Count others as more significant than yourselves. That word count is inviting us to do some work. It's asking us the question, do I count others as more significant? Or when I'm stacking up the sort of bills here, is it me or is it others? Do I count others as more significant, or do I count me as more significant? But what is more significant in our life? What's more weighty in our life? Pride says me. Humility says others. So Paul says, do nothing from selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Then he goes on to verse 4. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interest of others. Pride makes it impossible to see others as significant. And because we can't see others as significant, pride then makes it impossible for us to ever sacrifice for their good. We can't do it. Pride will never sacrifice for the good of another. Pride will never lose personally so that others can gain. Pride is just incapable of doing that. But humility really is a gift that frees us to enjoy other people, to love other people, to see other people, to sacrifice for the good of other people, to bless other people, to encourage other people. Now we can start to see why Andrew Murray would say humility really is the first duty. It really is first. It's the highest virtue of the creature. It's the root of every other virtue. If you are going to be obedient to Jesus, it's going to be because humility has found a home in you. In Galatians chapter 5, Paul reminds us, he says, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word. That's Paul's way of saying everything the Lord requires of his people, wants from his people, is summarized in this single sentence. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's it. There's obedience right there to Jesus. That's a simple way to say, here's what God wants from his people. But here is the problem. Pride poisons our relationships. Pride makes it impossible to love people. But humility creates the capacity to do that. It creates the capacity to love people and to serve people and to lay down your life for the good of people. Humility gives you the ability to do that. So this is a good time for us to pause and just begin to ask the question, where do I see pride showing up in my life? Can I see humility in my life? Can I find that anywhere? Is the poison of pride, is it in me? Is it filling up my heart? Here's a good test that you can use. When it comes to obedience, a humble person refuses to draw a line they will not cross for God. So a humble person says, God, what you want, that's going to win. And here's why. Because you're God and I'm not. Because it's your will before my will. So when my will and your will clash, God, I'm going to go with you, not me. That's a humble person. A prideful person, on the other hand, is looking at God and saying, God, my obedience will only go so far, but here is the line, and if you ask me to cross that line, I just want to tell you up front, not doing it. That is the heart of pride. Right? It's a heart that is saying, it is my will, not your will, oh God. So where are you seeing pride and humility at war within you? Chances are you have a place right now in your life where you've drawn that line and pride is saying, I will go this far but no more, oh God. And God is looking at you and saying, that's a poison that's going to kill you. It's going to kill you. Why do we need humility? Let me give you a couple of reasons why we need humility. Why do you need humility? Why do I need humility? Here's one reason. Humility precedes unity. Now, let's think about this letter to the church in Philippi. In Acts chapter 16, we get the story of how this church was started. It started because Paul shows up and God saves Lydia, God saves a slave girl, and God saves the equivalent of a policeman and his family. Right? So God does that miracle, and then God keeps doing miracles, and this church is born, and then it takes off. And if you look at all the churches in the New Testament, this church was the most mature and most grown up. So now, it's about 10 years later when Paul writes this letter to the church, and Paul is writing back to them to both encourage and correct them. And here is the one thing he is primarily addressing in terms of correction in this church. It is a lack of unity. It's a lack of unity. That's if you have a problem in this church, it's that. It's a lack of unity. Over the last 10 years of just this church's life, okay, it was planted, been going for 10 years. Now here we are, Paul's addressing them. And here's what has happened over that 10 years. Romanticism turned into real life. It's like you get married on day one, think it's going to be all awesome. And then year 10 shows up and you're like, wow, where did that awesomeness go? This is a lot harder than I thought. Like real life kind of showed up in the middle of this awesomeness, right? And that's what happened to this church. Romanticism, this is all going to be amazing. Look at what God's doing, turns into real life. Remaining sin broke into this church, and then that sin began to break relationships. People had been, they had done the sinning, and people had been sinned against, right? And all these disappointments had begun to mount in this church. And isn't it a good thing that that only happened to churches a couple of thousand years ago? Just no church today has any of those types of problems. It's amazing. But Paul is writing to them because Paul wants to tell them what is required to make it through relational conflict. And here it is in a word. Humility. Humility. Without that, you'll never make it through. So Paul says, in humility, you have to count others as more significant than yourselves. You have to look not only to your own interests, but also to the interest of others. Maybe we could say it this way. Here's what Paul is teaching us. That the road to unity is paved with humility. Or we could say it this way. The road through relational conflict is paved with humility. That's the road. You're walking on humility. And if pride comes in, it will poison all of that stuff. It'll poison all of your relationships. It'll poison all of that unity. Church, let me just pause here for a moment and recognize something in our church right now in this season. It is probably in 16 years of our church's life, the height of our unity as a church. And that is a sweet, sweet gift from the Lord. There's a reason why the psalmist says in Psalm 133, "Behold, how good and pleasant is it when brothers dwell in unity." It's a great gift from God. And we have that right now in ways that are just amazing. I'm so, so grateful for it. But here is the warning. Unity does require humility, ongoing humility. Without humility, unity is possible. Without humility, all I can see is what I want, not what you might need or not what we collectively might need. Right? Pride just poisons all of those things. So, church, I just want to look at you and just do everything I can to plead with you. Will you join me in staying low? Staying humble. Killing pride. not counting ourselves as too much. For the sake of unity, would you just keep down that road with me? Let's just keep walking down that road paved in humility. And apply this to your own life right now where you have personal conflicts. Friends, that road is paved with humility. The moment you lose humility is the moment that all of that relationship is going to be lost. So stay humble. Stay low with the Lord in that. Humility precedes unity. Here's the second reason we need humility. Humility attracts God's help. It's an amazing thing to consider in the Bible. 1 Peter 5:5, Peter says, God opposes the proud, right? We've already talked about that, but here's the other side of it. But God gives grace to the humble. Isn't that amazing? God gives grace to the humble. It is as if humility just draws the grace of God toward it. It draws the gaze of God toward it. I love Isaiah 66. Listen to these words from the Lord in Isaiah 66. But this is the one to whom I look. So who is God looking at in this world? He scans across humanity. And what people, what type of person draws the gaze of God? This is the one to whom I look. He who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word. That's who? The humble. Where pride draws God's opposition, humility draws God's grace-giving attention. It draws God's help. In the Bible, grace flows downhill. And if you are lifted up in pride, grace will never find you there. But if you will get low down in the valley, grace is going to flow right to you there. Grace flows downhill. Humility attracts the kindness, the favor, the help of God. To everyone who is proud, all of God's power is working against you. But to the humble, God's mighty power is working for you. Humility attracts God's help. And thirdly, why do we need humility? Because humility will be exalted. You know, if you just read the New Testament, one of the things you're going to find is the way of Jesus is just an upside down type of way. It's not, Jesus's way is not like the world's way. They're two very different things. So we read things like this from the lips of Jesus. The first are going to be last. The last are going to be first. We read things like that because it really is an upside down way of seeing the world. If you boil it down, God offers one of two plans to every person. Here is plan A. You lower yourself, humble yourself, and God says, that's really valuable to me, so one day I'm going to lift you up. Here's plan B. You lift yourself up. It's called pride in the Bible. You lift yourself up. You get yourself in that high place, and God says, that is not attractive to me. So here's what I'm going to do one day. One day, I'm going to lower you, humiliate you. Those are the two options. It's lower yourself and be exalted, or it's lift yourself up and be lowered. In church, can we just all collectively say plan A is better? Can we just all say we're going to take the low route and let God do his lifting? We're just going to go down that route together. So now the question really becomes, how do we grow in humility? How do we grow in humility? You have never met a person that is too humble. You've never met that person. Just like you've never met a person too encouraged. We are all proud people pursuing humility by the grace of God. That's what we are. That's what we are as a church. So how do we do that pursuing work? How do we pursue humility? Let me just give you two encouragements. Number one is to look out, to find people to serve. Look out. Stop looking in. Look out, find people to serve, someone to serve. This is verse 4. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others. Find a need out there in the world and just give yourself to meeting those needs. Right? This is one way we can grow in humility. William Booth started the Salvation Army, and toward the end of his life, he was about to die, they were having an annual Salvation Army conference, kind of their moment of getting all their people together. But his health was just too bad to get there, so he sent his sermon ahead. He just sent his sermon to be read. And the people there said it was the most powerful sermon they had ever heard. And it was just one word. So now I have something to aspire to right there. One word, right? Here was the one word sermon. Others. Others. Then a hymn eventually got sort of connected to that little one-word sermon. This hymn was written about 100 years ago. It says this: Lord, let me live from day to day in such a self-forgetful way that even when I kneel to pray, my prayer shall be for others. Others, Lord, yes, others. Let this my motto be: help me to live for others that I may live like thee. That, friends, is a humble prayer. And if Christmas should do anything to us, the advent of Jesus should do anything for Jesus' people, it is to turn their gaze out to other people to figure out how to meet their needs, to serve them. So I just want to encourage you, December, take this Advent season as just a prompting from the Lord to say, how can we find some people, look out, how can we find people to serve, to meet their needs this Christmas season? So one is to look out. Here's the second way. If we're going to pursue humility, the second thing we can do is to look up, just to keep our gaze up to Jesus. So Paul goes on in verse 5, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. We're going to spend time next week right there in that text, but I just want you to see that, because in the incarnation of Jesus, we see the humility of Jesus. What you got a couple of thousand years ago when Jesus came and walked among us is a living, breathing picture of humility. It's Jesus putting himself in human clothes and then receiving all the limits of what it means to be human. I mean, just picture this. It's God taking the form of a newborn baby, completely helpless, and then a toddler, and then a teenager, for crying out loud. This is God just taking on all the limitations of what it means to be human. But the humility of Jesus goes further. His humility took him all the way to the point of death, even death by crucifixion. Friends, when you look at Jesus, you are looking at humility. That's what you're seeing. That's what you're looking at. This is why one commentator says, the gospel announces that God is not what we think. God has no swagger. God has no pride, no bluff, no defensive face saving, no pushing to the head of the line. All this stuff that the world has, God has none of that in him. God, on the other hand, is humble. He does nothing from rivalry, though we picked a fight with him. He does nothing from conceit, though we puffed ourselves up against him. God made himself nothing. He took the form of a servant. He humbled himself in obedience all the way to death on a cross. That is our God. And when you gaze upon God, you are looking at humility. So friends, if you want to grow in humility, keep staring at Jesus. Just see him there in that cradle. See him there hanging from the cross. That is where humility will begin to grow in you. Martin Lloyd-Jones is right when he says, there's only one thing I know that crushes me to the ground. There's only one thing I know that humiliates me to the dust. There's only one thing I know, he's saying, that actually produces humility in my heart. And here it is: looking to the Son of God, looking at Jesus. So friend, this Christmas season, just keep looking at Jesus there in the cradle. There on the cross, keep looking at Jesus. Let me finish with this story from C.S. Lewis. In one of his books, it's called Paralandra, C.S. Lewis tries to reimagine the Garden of Eden. So he just kind of a Garden of Eden 2.0. I'm going to tell the story of Genesis 1, 2, and 3 in a fictional telling, a new telling, just reimagining what that could have been like. And so he tells the story of the green lady. This is the Eve-like person in his story, the Eve-like character. And she is being tempted So it's just a redoing of Genesis 3 where the serpent comes into the garden and tempts Eve. Now that this man comes into this new world that C.S. Lewis has created, and he is tempting the green lady, Eve. And the temptation comes in the form of a mirror. A mirror is the temptation. So for the first time in her life, she sees herself. Like, there I am. For the first time in her life, this moment happens. Until this moment, her thoughts had always been up toward God, out into his world, and out into the joy of being with others. All of her thoughts were this way and that way. But now for the first time, it's this way. In that moment, something new and dangerous entered her mind. The temptation to look at herself, not up and not out. That has a name in the Bible. It's called pride. That inward turn, that silent, invisible poison that when it fills up a human heart, centers everything on us, not God, not others. That's pride. But today, church, Jesus wants to give us humility. Jesus is inviting us to turn away from the mirror, to look up at him and out at others. So maybe you could just think about the invitation from Paul, from God today for you is, would you put down the mirror? Would you just stop thinking about you all the time? Would you put down the mirror? Would you stop drinking the poison of pride? And would you lift your eyes to Jesus, the one who took on human form, the one who humbled himself all the way to the point of death, even death on a cross? And then, friends, would we all together go with him down into that place of humility?